This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Well, it's nice to see everybody here today. The traffic just is terrible. I think people are running someplace for something, probably some good cause. But it sure messes up the traffic flow. So a couple stories. As some of you might know, a couple Sundays a month, I find myself at Vietnamese temples teaching children about the Dharma. And these are temples that pretty much have children that were born here and only speak English. And so they thought it might be good to get an English speaker to speak to the children. And so I was asked to speak to the children through my friend Michelle, who is Vietnamese, and has an organization called the International Buddhist Education Center. So her focus is on children, or at least was on children, until yesterday. So she has been working on this for a couple months, and she got me into Leisure World. Now, I don't know if you've been to Leisure World. I hadn't been to Leisure World, and I thought, well, isn't it just like a bunch of old people living together? Well, it is a bunch of old people living together. You have to be at least 55 to live at Leisure World. So I didn't quite know what to expect. And to be honest with you, they all sort of look like me. And I thought to myself, gosh. You know, that's interesting, you know. I guess I qualify. And this was going to be the first of a series of talks on meditation. And Michelle had a whole group of Vietnamese volunteers, and they were arranging the cushions on the floor, and they had some wonderful rugs, and there were chairs lined up all around the room, and they had brought food. They had made food and had drink. And it's sort of traditional after meditation or Dharma talk, everybody eats. So Michelle always likes to bring food. And one of the things I realized as I was in Leisure World talking to everybody was that fact that most of them weren't going to be sitting on the floor. You know, and a couple volunteered saying they could sit on the floor, but they couldn't get up. You know, so we'd have to either arrange for a group of people to get everybody up, or maybe just let them sit in the chairs. And so Michelle really wanted everybody to sit on the floor, but she hadn't factored in age and flexibility. So it was mostly the Vietnamese volunteers and Michelle and a few of the Vietnamese nuns who didn't speak English who sat on the floor and meditated. And then there was me. And I decided to stand most of the time so they could see me. And the first thing that impressed them about me was I spoke English. And I said, well, you know, that's about all I speak, and I'm glad you appreciate that fact. But they had this vision of this Asian person coming who spoke broken English and had different cultural reference points, and it was going to be a real challenge to figure out how to meditate. And then there was me. So I wanted them to feel good about me, so I told them I was old just like they were. And I could still get on the floor and I could still get up, but I got up slower than I used to. And then I started talking about the importance of meditation and coming to the present moment experience of your life and how useful it is to die. Now, when I use those terms with the children, it sort of fell on deaf ears that talking about life and death to someone who's seven has little to no meaning, because they're so close to birth that death seems like a really, really, really long way away. And when you're speaking to somebody who's 85 about death, they're going, yeah, I get it. And so Buddhism really talks a lot about how to live and how to die. And I hadn't realized how much it talks about it until 2 weeks ago. I was invited to do a memorial service on a 60-foot yacht off of Ventura. And apparently what you need to do is get at least 3 miles offshore. So you could either gamble or have a memorial service. You know, one of the two. We decided to have the memorial service. And we had this box of ashes, and the captain said, do you know which way downwind is? And I'm going, you know, that's probably a really good thing to know as we throw the ashes over the side, because it is sort of, you don't want that, you know? And it was a nice sort of traditional American Vietnamese memorial service. But nobody on the ship was Buddhist. Most of them didn't know about Buddhism. The person who had died was Catholic and had actually been a Catholic monk for a while. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why he would want a Buddhist service, but of course he wasn't there. But why would his family want a Buddhist service for him, you know? And so I did the little Buddhist service, and it was interesting to them. They'd never heard of bodhisattvas before. And in this particular service, we're naming all the bodhisattvas and some of the Buddhas, and we're hoping they go to the Pure Land in the West so I'll meet a Buddha. And they're just sort of watching me do all this, and the boat's going like this, you know, back and forth. And we're just sort of like, you know, I'm just ringing the gong and doing my chanting. And then I said to them, after I did the Buddha service, do you want to say a prayer, a Christian prayer for him? And they all said no. And I'm going, okay. So I just kept going on with the Buddha stuff, and then over the side. And then we all ate, you know, on the ship. And then we, you know, took the boat back to shore, and then we ate again. A lot of eating goes on at the funerals, you know. And so I thought to myself, well, that's really interesting, but we really never talked too much about death. We talked about what happens after death. And I realized one of the important things about Buddhism as a religion is it really gives you a place to go. And that can be problematic if you're an atheist or a secular humanist and really haven't put too much thought into where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. So my brother, who's 59 now, is a non-religious person, intelligent, master's degree in accounting, but really doesn't know what happens after life. And so he's starting to freak out now. He says, if I'm lucky, I got about 25 good years, maybe 30. That's not very long, 30 years, he says. You know, and there's still some things I'd like to do, and I don't know, it just gives me the creeps to think I've only got like 30 years to go. And then he says to me, how do you feel about that? And I said, well, I'm getting sort of tired. You know, and maybe 30 years will be enough, because by the time that rolls around, you know, you can't get up when you sit down. You might have some diseases that can't be cured. You know, you may not be able to hear very well or see very well. And, you know, there's not much reason to keep hanging around, because there's nothing you're going to do except sit and watch Fox News on TV. You know, I think that's what happens when you get past a certain point. So as I thought about it, and I'm looking at my audience at Leisure World, I'm thinking this is really the most appropriate thing they could be doing on a Saturday afternoon, is learning how to meditate. And thinking about life and death, and thinking about what it means to them and what they need to do with the time they have left. And of course, none of us know how much time we have left. And that's the wild card, isn't it? You know, I think Holly's good for 40 years, but, you know, walking across Melrose, who knows? So then I'm thinking to myself, well, how am I going to really inspire the people at Leisure World to meditate? What do I need to say to them? And I talked about this last time I was here a little bit, and it has more and more meaning for me now. That early Buddhism, the original Buddhism, I love to say that, more orthodox approach, the Theravada tradition, the Indian tradition, really was more of a therapy about how to live in the world and not feel uncomfortable. It wasn't much of a religion, really. You know, there were references to deities, but they were references to the deities of being unskillful. And that the historical Buddha actually gave Dharma talks to the angels and devas, the deities in India, about how to suffer less and be more skillful in their realm of existence. So many realms of existence, and in all those realms of existence, suffering occurs, even in the heaven realm. And so the Buddha didn't say, you all need a good religion, you all need a new religion. He didn't bring his tent with him. He said, hey, you know, humans have a real problem in experiencing the world. And maybe what we need to do is experience the world in a different way so we can be happy and we can be peaceful and we can be content. And if we just experience the world in our normal way, we're faced with lust and greed and hatred and delusion. And that causes us a lot of discomfort. And if we could experience the world with love and generosity and compassion and wisdom, then that experience, that personal experience, would allow us to live in a more comfortable way. So I'm talking to the group at Leisure World about this, and they're going, yeah, okay, that sounds good. Let's not suffer. And then I said, well, you know, one of the ways to start this practice is to come to the present moment experience of your life. And it sounded like a sort of, you know, abstract way of looking at it, but really, most of us aren't experiencing our life in the present moment. Most of us are experiencing our life through past or future, through ideas of what we should have done and what we're going to do. And now, sitting here, we're sort of listening to Kusala, but now we're, you know, factoring in all the other talks we've heard and all the books we've read and all the hours of meditation we've done. And so that's triggering all this stuff in our brain. And I don't know how many of us are, like, really here. The people that are here are the ones who are feeling pain right now. So if any of you are feeling pain, I see we have a person lying down, that is an indication that the body was uncomfortable. And to me, that means that she is here in the present moment, because that pain always happens right now. So if any of you are feeling any discomfort at all, welcome to the present moment. Here we are. If you're not feeling discomfort, you're probably still vacillating between past and future. Okay, so I looked at the people at Leisure World and I knew they had pain. You could just tell by the way they walked, you know? And not only that, but I encouraged them to not run away from that, but just to look at it, to look at the pain as the portal to the present moment experience of your life. But rather than using pain as the focus of our meditation, I suggested to them that we use the breath. It's a bit more neutral. It's not really pleasant, it's not really unpleasant. Unpleasant if you can't breathe, perhaps. But if you're just breathing normally, we're not even aware of it, you know? Okay, so I said, let's see if we can feel the sensation of breath at the tip of the nose. And that means that you are feeling something in the present moment. So nobody got on the floor, but we all sat in the chairs. And I sat in the chair, too, to make them feel more comfortable. And I had the microphone. I said, okay, now we're going to feel the sensation of breath. And now what you need to do is you got to figure out if you want to watch the in-breath or the out-breath or both. So I heard sort of like mumbling around the room as they decided which one they're going to follow. And, and then I said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to use numbers. And what those numbers do, they allow us to have something to connect to the sensation of breath. Because the simple observation of the sensation of breath is very subtle, and sometimes we just lose it. We can't figure out where the breath is. It sometimes seems to go away for a while. But if you apply a number to the sensation of breath, then your mind is engaged in the activity of meditation. Okay, so we have this sort of intellectual aspect called counting, and then we have this sort of the sensation of breath, which actually transcends the intellect. And so we all counted from 1 to 10 to 10 to 1, 1 to 10 to 10 to 1. And we did that for probably about 10 minutes. And then I did a loving kindness meditation. And I said, you know, it's so important to do loving kindness meditation every day, in the morning and the evening. And if you can sit for 5 or 10 minutes and meditate and just count your breath. And one of the great things about breath counting, if you're not counting your breath, then you're not meditating. And if you are counting your breath, then you are meditating. And then sometimes when you start to meditate, you don't know if you're really meditating or not. So breath counting is a really good way to know if you're meditating. And so they all really loved the loving kindness meditation. They all wanted a copy of the loving kindness meditation. They all wanted to recite that every day. And I'm thinking, that is so cool, because that's like uploading this really useful information on how to be kind. And what did the Dalai Lama say about Buddhism as a religion? He said, you know, if you're just kind, you're a good Buddhist. And I thought, wow, you know, is that setting the bar a little too low, being kind? And then if you live in L.A., you realize the bar is pretty high. Because being kind is difficult. And so we all sort of worked through this whole thing of the first meditation experience. And I really enjoyed the enthusiasm, because some of them had never meditated before. They'd heard the concept of meditation. It was sort of, you know, otherworldly to them. The breath counting sort of put it into, you know, a practical application that they could do. And they actually felt a little different after meditating. So I'm going to be going back once a month, and next month I'm taking my ukulele just to have a little show for them, because I think they appreciate that, you know. And they'll give me something to do. So now, having said that, and talking about life and death, I want to share some insights I had this week. Yeah, part of this week and part of last week. And I'm going to try to be cavalier and detached. So we'll see how that goes. So a couple months ago in June, I went to visit Mom. Mom was sick. Mom's old. Mom was 84. So Mom passed away now. But when I went to see her, I thought it was just fascinating, because what I wanted to see is how she was going to die. Now, that may sound really morbid if you're not a Buddhist or don't get into death meditation, because Buddhism has a whole thing about death meditation. And I wanted to see how Mom was going to do it, because Mom had been non-religious most of her life, and in the last few months had found Lutheranism again. And her first husband was a Lutheran. She had been non-religious. Her parents were non-religious. Her second husband was an Episcopalian, and she decided to become a Lutheran. And I met the pastor, a really nice guy, but I wouldn't want to be Lutheran myself. That's just me. And she prayed, and I thought, wow, that is so cool. Mom is praying, you know? And I'm thinking, I wonder if Mom has a concept of afterlife, because for all the years, she had a very strong concept of this life. For kids she had to raise, she was a single mom with a toddler for years and years and years, and didn't remarry until her youngest son turned 18. And I thought that was so cool, that she married and had four kids, and then got divorced for a number of reasons, none of them clear to me, and then waited to remarry until the last son was legal and out of the house. And so then she had a wonderful life with him, and then he died. And she helped him die really well. He died at home, and she got home hospice, and she da-da-da-da-da. And she helped her parents die, her mother and father, she helped them die. But now she's dying, and there's nobody to help her die, which we may find in our own life at some point, you know, as we help our parents die, and maybe our older brothers and sisters. And I got a kick out of it at the funeral. They said, well, you know, who's next? And they all pointed at me, like, when I went. So it's not easy being the oldest son, you know. And so Mom was getting sick, and Mom was getting worse. But Mom, you know, had worked her whole life. Author of three books, journalist, always engaged in making a living to raise her kids. But then she got just to the point where she enjoyed working and have some place to go every day. At 79, she wrote a story about her going down the Colorado River on a raft. I have that story. And I'm thinking, Mom, you're 79, you know? But she did it her way. She always liked to do that. She brought a flask of scotch and a carton of cigarettes. And the only regret she had was she didn't bring enough scotch to last the whole trip. Because they were in the middle of nowhere and she couldn't go to the 7-Eleven. But that's sort of the kind of person she was. And for the last couple months of her life, she sat on the couch and literally watched Fox News every day. And Law and Order. She liked to watch people getting killed and then watch them, you know, solve the case and go to court. And so I had a little extra money, so I bought Mom a flat screen TV. It was on sale, Amazon.com. They delivered. So now Mom could watch Fox News on a flat screen TV. And she really liked that because now she could see the whole picture, she said. On her other TV, it looked too narrow. And I said, yeah, there's a lot to see on Fox News, Mom. I'm glad you got it. You got the whole picture now. So when she died, it was just remarkable because she never complained. She said she was uncomfortable sometimes. But she just went one foot in front of the other towards death. You know, she never complained that it was too early or that she had stuff to do. She had sort of like completed everything. And now she just wanted to die. And she died of kidney disease. She had renal failure. And that's what my cat died of. My cat died of that. I'm thinking, gosh, humans die of it. Cats die of it. She wanted no invasive procedures. She wanted no heroic efforts to keep her alive. She just wanted to feel comfortable when she died. And she kept asking me to bring her marijuana from California because she knew we had this, you know, medical marijuana. Now, I don't know if she ever smoked marijuana in her whole life, but I think she probably watched the news and thought that was a good idea. But I explained to her that if I took marijuana across state lines, you'd have to visit me in jail. You know? So in the end, she was doing sort of more medical therapy than marijuana therapy and didn't feel any kind of pain and didn't seem to experience much suffering. You know, and she was cremated. And I said to my brother, is anybody going down to watch the cremation? And he said, no. And, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, you go to the crematorium and you do chanting. And you wish that, you know, you hope and you encourage that the spirit or the life energy or the karmic energy, whatever you'd like to label that stuff, goes to the next rebirth. Then, after the body is cremated, you look for the relics. Now, everybody's going to have relics left behind, and these are little bits and pieces of bone that are in the ashes. And so you get your gloves on, you go through the ashes, and you pick out the relics. And you can make rings out of them, or you can do jewelry, or you can just have a little box of relics. And relics are sort of interesting. You know, we all like relics. You know, you go to Dodgers game, you get a relic, you get a ticket stub. That's your relic for the Dodgers game. And you go here and you get a relic. And we like to collect relics because it reminds us of the event or person. And so I was surprised that the Lutherans don't really go and look for relics in the ashes or do any kind of chanting or prayer. But they throw a good funeral. And we had a singer, we had an organist, we had some really nice words. I had a chance to talk, and I tell you, the voice was just terrible. I'd expected to be in control. After all, I've been practicing meditation for 30 years. I'm getting close to something, probably old age. And I thought I had it, you know. But then you just fall apart because it's Mom. And Mom is like in every part of you. She's like buried deep. And if you think you're not going to feel Mom, forget it. So you do that, but then afterwards you have the food and the drink. And this is in a small town in Wisconsin. And they really like the drink in Wisconsin. You know? And you got to have cheese. You know, we have a lot of different kinds of cheese. And we had sausage. I don't know if anybody really is into sausage, but there's summer sausage and there's bratwurst. And we had all that kind of stuff. Sodium, you know, animal parts, who knows what's in there. But they all taste really good. It was our way of saluting Mom as she was going off into her next journey. The thing I hadn't realized, and you may find this too, as you know, go to these things and you have siblings, is the family dynamic changes completely. Because each person has their own way of dealing with this stuff. You know? And some people work. They have things to do. And some people drink. And some people tell jokes. And I thought it was just fascinating. And everybody is in charge. Every four brothers and sisters, we're all in charge. in our own little way, and we all know what to do next. And of course, the other three don't agree with us, and we just sort of like sort of working through all this stuff. And it turns out that home is where mom is. So anywhere where mom is, that's where home is. And so mom's now ashes, and mom has a home, and has a whole lot of stuff. And so what do you do with mom's stuff? You have a yard sale. What else would you do? And so we had a yard sale on Saturday and a funeral on Sunday. Small house, a lot of stuff. And everybody came and bought mom's stuff. And no women were with us. It was all guys. It was the brothers and the male friends who were all out there. And the women would come to look at the stuff and say, where are the prices? Because if women were running the yard sale, everything would be priced. But the guys are going, oh, that's $3, you know. And if that's too much, then we give it for $1, and it works out fine. So we sold everything. Unbelievable. Mom's couch, you know, we call it the death couch, but mom's couch, $40. You know, we didn't tell anybody what happened on that couch. She didn't. She didn't die in the couch. She died in bed. She died at home. It was a wonderful, you know, rare to die at home. But we got her home. She made it out of the hospital alive, took her home, was dead in 6 hours. That's how much she wanted to die at home. But that couch was her operation, you know, platform. She sat on that couch for days and days and days watching. That couch went for $40, all leather. We cleaned it off a little bit. Sold the chairs, sold the dishes, everything, towels, clothing. Three people wanted to buy the car, and 4 people wanted to buy the house. How cool is that? But you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of all the turmoil and acquisition we make in our lifetimes. You know, we all have a lot of stuff. Even I have a lot of stuff, and I just live in a room. But I got stuff everywhere. And then you die, and then you have all this stuff. And so friends and relatives have to get rid of your stuff for you. And I'm thinking, wouldn't it be nice if just before we die, we start having our own yard sale? You know? So by the time we die, we get a chair and a lamp, you know. That's all we have. You're just leaving a couple things behind. But most of us are going to have a lot of stuff to get rid of. And so hopefully we'll have a good yard sale. Then I'm thinking, okay, she's gone now. And what am I going to do? You know, my sister drank, my brother arranged the yard sale, my other brother from Texas got a U-Haul truck and took a lot of her stuff to Texas, I guess to have his own yard sale. I'm not sure why he took all this stuff, you know? And I got a couple pictures. That's what I got, you know? And why did I get a couple pictures? Well, I was flying, and the second bag cost $25. So, I did a website. So I'm doing a website in memorial, you know, it's a sort of memorial website. And she has 10,000 copies of her books. You know, she wrote books of Northwood's nostalgia and personal profiles of the people that lived in the community where she lived. And she worked for the newspaper, and that was one of the things that she did. She just took all the articles and put them in. So my brother has 10,000 books that the newspaper gave him. It said, these books are yours. We're not going to sell her books anymore. You sell them. So I said to my brother, I'll make a website. We'll sell our books through the website. So we're not going to charge any shipping. And I'm thinking, well, 10,000 books, how long will that take to sell? Well, I'll be dead by the time we're all But then he said, let's take them to Amazon. We'll put them on Amazon.com. And you send them a couple cases. They do all the shipping. They take a little percentage. They give you the rest of the money. Piece of cake. So my way of remembering mom was to do a website. And I was able to find some pictures when she was really young and some pictures when she was really old and then some pictures in the middle. In the arc of a life, I'm thinking to myself, how fascinating is that? How can you not believe in rebirth when you see the arc of a life in pictures? Because those people are not the same people. The person at 80 has nothing at all to do with the person at 8. They are totally unique. And they die. And that 8-year-old had to die for the 9-year-old to be born. And on it goes. And through our whole life, we're living and dying, living and dying. once in a while having a yard sale, getting rid of all the old clothes we're never going to wear again. Because the person that wore those clothes died in 1967. In those bell bottoms, though, we probably could sell them at a pretty good price today. A few years ago, nobody wanted them. So looking at her pictures, I thought, wow, this is just fascinating. In all the years, her name was Joyce, and I never met Joyce. Joyce was dead by the time I showed up. Why do I say that? Because Mom was there. And the stories I heard about Joyce at her funeral, that wasn't Mom. Mom was putting us to bed and making sure we went to school. Who was this woman out partying and having a great time? That wasn't Mom. That was Joyce. So I never had a chance to meet Joyce, but she sounded like a really fun person and would have been really nice to know. But Mom was good, too. Mom did all the things that Mom was supposed to do. And so we honored Mom. But her friends honored Joyce. And her fellow employees honored the person who they met at work, who wasn't the person I knew or the person her friends knew. So throughout our life, we have all these little sort of personas, it seems, where we're role-playing and we're doing our work and we're doing our fun and we're doing our relationships and we're friends and lovers and best buddies and we're all these different kinds of people. And then you find Buddhism, and Buddhism says, you know, you're none of those people. You're all of those people at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of really hard to figure out who you are and what you need to be. And I think one of the challenges we have is living in LA is who do we need to be today to get through the day in a skillful way that prevents our suffering or at least reduces our suffering? And once we start to figure out who we are or who we aren't, then we sort of figure out how we're going to die. Because that person dies all the time, every day. And in the 35 minutes we sat together today, we were all dying into the present moment experience of our life. We were practicing to die, literally. And when it gets time for the body to die, we have maybe 10, 20, 30 years under our belt of dying, of practicing for 15 or 20 minutes a day to die. And how does it feel to die into the present moment? Well, there's not a whole lot of fear, you know? It's sort of interesting, isn't it, when you sit down to meditate and you hear the gong and you come to your object of meditation, whatever that might be, and what you find is your body gets like really relaxed. But then your mind, rather than getting relaxed like your body, gets a little more clear and precise. And it doesn't, for the most part, seem sleepy or diffused, but there's a certain clarity that comes in meditation, I find. And yet, I have this relaxed, really relaxed body that needs to stay that way so it doesn't feel much pain. And now, if you keep meditating and you do concentration meditation, samatha meditation, you start to see that there are all sorts of aspects of consciousness that you become aware of, internal aspects of consciousness. And sometimes there's light and motion and color. Fascinating. Sometimes sounds are being heard that may or may not have anything to do with your reality outside, but there's internal sounds. And it doesn't seem scary at all. It seems actually rather peaceful. It seems like in some cases we're coming home to that original energy we started with. That little furnace that lives inside of us that creates this energy, whatever that energy is, and all things in the world have that same energy. And we become aware of that, and then we see how we're all connected through that energy. And again, I don't want to really name it because that means it's not what it is. And you might have some concepts about that. Some people might call it God. I always get a little nervous about that because I picture God as being old with a gray beard. And I don't want him inside of me. You know. But this is sort of this energy. Light might be good. Have you ever been meditating and you found light inside of your head? Whoa! That's always there? That's so cool. And have you noticed when people die, sometimes they see light? You know? Maybe they're seeing that original light that's always been part of us, part of that energy. And they say, you know, go towards the light, go towards the light. And sometimes when you're meditating and the light happens, don't you want to go towards that? Doesn't it just seem like it's going to burn away all your bad karma? Mm-hmm. And just sort of like purify you in like one moment of brilliance? And then you gong rings and you wake up and you're just like this new person being reborn in the present moment again. You go, ah. But about an hour later, you're the same person that walked into the meditation. Didn't seem to last long enough, so you keep doing it every day, hoping it will last one day. So I saw that, and I'm thinking we're really lucky that we have a practice. We're really lucky that we have these ideas of internal consciousness and light and karma and afterlife. And a lot of people poo-poo afterlife as being, oh, you know, who knows, and nobody's ever come back and told us, and I don't think it's really useful, and, you know, I'm just going to live this life to the fullest and see what happens. And all really good words, you know, until you get old and get ready to die. And then it really might be nice to have an afterlife. Even if it doesn't exist at all, it still might be nice to think about that and sort of imagine what you're going to be like in that afterlife. And then your consciousness starts to die. And you can read about that in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo's, how the consciousness dies. But a much more interesting book to read, based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is called The Psychedelic Experience. Has anybody heard of The Psychedelic Experience? Am I the only one? I've never taken psychedelics. But you know what? This was written by Tim Leary. This was written by Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner. And what they did is they took the Tibetan Book of the Dead and they used it as a guide to LSD, showing how your consciousness sort of falls apart and you come to this place of no self or not self. And then you ride the journey for 12 hours or so, and it has little things to help you, you know, get over it. If you start to freak out, you spread out on the floor face down and hug the earth, giving you, you know, a sense of balance and anchor, you know. But a fascinating book. It's been reprinted like 100 times. It's on Amazon.com. It's the perfect book for a meditator because it talks about our experience in meditation and the way our consciousness responds to that. So I'm not advocating LSD, but I am advocating this book because it's, for me, it was just fascinating to read and see the similarities between the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the updated version of psychedelics. Our body, thankfully, will not resist dying. Because our body doesn't even know it's alive. Our body is really stupid. It just sort of does things at an instinctual level and keeps talking to the mind to get stuff done. Like the body's hungry, it signals the mind, find me some food. And the mind, being smart and intuitive and flexible, oftentimes is able to find food, and the body's satisfied. So the body's just like this real basic thing. And now the body's going to die, no problemo. Body will die really easily. The son of a gun to die is the mind, the ego, the self. It doesn't want to go. It's been in charge its whole life. It knows what the world's all about. It knows what life's all about. Again, going back to our meditation practice, watching the ego die, and maybe not die, maybe just being anesthetized, allows us to see the process of anesthetizing ego, transcending ego, and allowing the ego to come to a place of peace with the present moment experience of sitting or dying. And can you imagine how interesting that'll be for all of us as we're there, you know, and maybe we're still in the hospital, didn't make it out of the hospital to get home, and we've got this little thing above our head and it's going ding, 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 you know, and then all of a sudden it sort of flat lines, you know. But as a meditator, we're aware of the flat line. And we're going, whoa, and then our light gets really strong. And then we watch our last breath. But nothing comes back in. And then we go into our next rebirth. If you believe in the next rebirth. We might go to heaven. We might just stay in the hospital for a while. Wherever you go. Can you imagine doing that? Wouldn't that be just the best trip you've ever had? The last trip you've ever had? And everybody's so sad to see you go. And you're right there in the front seat of the bus, can hardly wait for, you know, to go to that next place. Because this life is over. Can we let go of this life completely? Does meditation allow us to let go of 20 minutes completely? Of 45 minutes of our life completely? How does that feel, to let go of 45 minutes of your life completely and sit quietly? It doesn't feel that bad at all. It's just sort of letting go. Thoughts come, you let them go. Pain comes, you let that go. You're just sort of like opening up your hand 1,000 times in that 45 minutes to let things go and pass away. And then something else takes its place. And you're like the river, and you just have this big flow thing going on. You know? And how cool is that? Fear? I don't think so. Sadness and happiness? I don't think so. Because we got stuff to do. We're not just waiting for somebody to take us away. We're actively participating in our own demise. We're putting one foot in front of the other, consciously walking straight ahead. Fear? Maybe not. Maybe after 20 years of meditation, maybe fear isn't part of the model or the paradigm. Maybe it's our last big teaching. And maybe some of us who are reborn will remember that teaching and figure out where we left off and not have to start all over again. Wouldn't that be cool? Because we'll probably have some new editions of the books we read in the last time. But, you know, it'd be nice not to have to buy them. So those are some of the thoughts that came to me. Was it sad? Absolutely. Sad to say goodbye. But you know what? We say goodbye to ourselves every day. And we say goodbye to all our friends and relatives every day. Because the person we meet next time is brand new. They may not look brand new, but they are. Now, one last insight I had. This was at the party. I actually had a beer or two, but not enough to really alter my reality too much. And there was this guy who lives a few doors down from my brother on this lake. And I looked at him, and he sort of looked familiar, but not really. And then he comes up and says, "Do you remember me? My name is Johnny Keeble, and I live a couple doors down from your brother." And I watched him manifest completely differently in a few moments. He went from someone I didn't know to someone I did know. And I saw my mind rewrite him. It was just a trip. And it just, all of a sudden, he just morphed into something else. He morphed into familiarity. And I was able to see the transformation. I just watched really carefully. And his whole face just changed. And then I said, "Yeah, I remember you." So I'm thinking, you know, my senility in not remembering people I talked to a year ago is going to be really interesting to watch them manifest in front of me in that present moment experience, becoming unfamiliar to familiar. And they, "Whoa, how are you?" Wow. That was so cool. Can you do it again? So anyway, does anybody have any comments or questions about what I've been talking about or what I've said? Yeah? Okay. Well, thanks for listening to what I had to say. Thanks for going on the journey with me. And hopefully your journey will be as interesting as mine. You know? Because all of us have just this wonderful life to live and this wonderful death to do. You know? It may not sound like a wonderful thing to do, but if you're ready to die, it might be, you know, the last great road trip. The last great road trip. So meditate every day. Get ready. So it won't be a problem. It'll be a teaching. Let's end with a loving kindness meditation. May those of us who have come together today in mind and heart be peaceful, happy, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May our parents, our partners, our pets, our brothers and sisters, our friends and family, all the people we don't know, all the people we don't like, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. From the highest realm of existence to the lowest, may all beings arisen in any of these realms, with form and without, with perception and without, with consciousness and without, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health relief. Turn it over to you.
Thank you, Crystal. Thank you all for being here this morning. If you're not already on our mailing list, you can sign up for that. We always have a lot of cool classes and series going on here against the stream. There's flyers up there, and also everything's on our website. All of our classes are donation-based. We request a $15 donation if it's something you can afford. If you can afford more, we greatly appreciate it. We have succeeded so far 3.5 years on your donations alone, so we really appreciate being able to do that. We never turn anyone away from Against the Stream for lack of funds, so if you can't afford anything at all, please know you can always be here. If you can only afford a few bucks, we appreciate that too. And thanks for coming.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.